I still can't buy TNA.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
I like the Pumpkins. I do. Actually, that's one of my favorite songs. Maybe my favorite song of the Smashing Pumpkins. It's a little song called Disarm. I'd say that's probably my favorite of the bunch. This is episode 463 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, October 2nd, 2016. I am the Solid Monster. Want to give a congrats to my New York Mets. They beat the Philadelphia Phillies yesterday, which is always satisfying to beat Philadelphia, and got themselves a wild card berth. Now it's on to the wild card game against either the Giants or the Cardinals on Wednesday. I posted a picture on Twitter of the championship belt that they've been using this year for their champion of the game. Still looks better than the Universal title. Still looks better than that belt. And by the way, Tim Tebow, his first at-bat in a Mets uniform on Wednesday, smacks a home run. I say call him up. Call him up right now. Want to give a shout-out to everybody who signed up with our Audible link this past week. A lot of people did. A lot of people took advantage of the 30-day Audible trial using our URL, audibletrial.com/solomonster. If you go through the sign-up process after punching in that link, you get to sample the service free for 30 days. You will not be billed. And you get one free audiobook that you get to keep even if you cancel your trial in those 30 days. So you can essentially get yourself a free audiobook on us. And a lot of people took advantage of that to pick up The Death of WCW, which is brand new on Audible. It is quite the story. So you can grab your copy right now of The Death of WCW. Use our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Don't forget we have our store up on prowrestlingtees.com/solomonstersoundsoff. Over 24 t-shirts to choose from. You can take a picture once you get your shirt. If you tweet it to me, I will be more than happy to retweet it out to everybody else. Love seeing people in Sound Off gear. And also, if you want to become a PayPal VIP, it's the quickest and easiest way to show your support for this podcast. You can make a donation at any time on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. Just click that donate button, and you're off to the races. You can make a donation of whatever you want, but that's the place to go for it. And I do want to say thank you. You can make a $10 donation or more to get yourself a shout out on the show and a wrestling nickname. $30 or more, you can get a shout out not only for yourself, but if you have a wrestling podcast of your own, a YouTube show, social media channel, your own business, that's the way to do it. Thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, who I think one day they should become a tag team, and then Deadpool will turn on Loose Cannon, and I would pay to see that match on pay-per-view. Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Keith the Conqueror Krajnik, Misfit Miguel Mendoza, Nemesis Nathan Moyers, Alvin Chainsaw Siegerts, Ian Lights Out Loomis, Massgrave Micah Harshaw, Save the World Sean Tilly, Bonebreaker Justin Bridge, The Molesy Mutilator, Kerry Bemrose, The Elite Dominic Drummond. And if you are a fan of Elite Wrestling Entertainment, even if you've not heard of them before, if you want to show your support for independent wrestling, they are hosting a huge event, EWE Grand Finale, on Saturday, October 22nd at the Morgan Jr. Arena in Wallington, New Jersey. Bell time is 7:30 p.m. You could check out Jordan, Grace, C. Bunny, Solo Darling, and Nikki Adams in a women's fatal four-way match. And the EWE champion, Everett Cross, will defend his title against Jonathan Gresham. So for more information on how to get tickets, visit EWEGrandFinale.eventbrite.com. That's event, BRITE.com. So thank you to Dominic and everybody else for showing their support for the podcast this week. I will be continuing my countdown of the 9 greatest interviews, promos in WWE history. We're doing one per week up until our 9-year anniversary show in November. It's about a month away. Last week was Paul Heyman's work shoot on Vince McMahon from SmackDown in 2001. This week, we're down to number 5 in the countdown. Top 5 territory already. And we'll get to that later on in the mailbag. I'll let that stew. I don't want to give away any hints here. There was a story on PW Insider on Thursday. You know, I mentioned, just gave a plug for an independent show in New Jersey. There was a story on PW Insider this week about major changes to the New York State Athletic Commission's guidelines that govern pro wrestling, because they do oversee them. It is overseen by the Athletic Commission here in New York. And it is not good news if you are an independent promotion operating here in this state. I got a text message from a friend who wrestles for a small indie promotion here, and he was saying, you know, these rules are going to make it impossible for them to run shows anymore. One of the rules is that every promotion has to have an ambulance on site with an EMT whenever there's a show, which sounds like a great idea, right? It's all about safety. But the problem is, not every indie promotion, in fact, many indie promotions, cannot afford to rent an ambulance for every single show. And there's a ton of other changes too. That's not the only one. Financially, it's going to make it much harder, if not impossible, for some of these promotions to run, and that's a real shame. The Clash of Champions pay-per-view was last Sunday. If you want my full thoughts, I have a full review up on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/TheSolomonster. You can head on over there. I go through the entire card. I thought overall, there was some good wrestling and just some head-scratching finishes up and down that card. It was not their strongest effort. I guess if I had to compare them, Raw versus SmackDown, you had Backlash and you had Clash of Champions, I'd go with Backlash personally. But it just, you know, it was okay, but it was by no means a show that I would tell you to go out of your way to watch. But there was some really good wrestling on there, so if that's your thing, you can go check that out. They had some footage up on WWE.com after the show. Why this didn't air on the pay-per-view, I have no idea. Of Stephanie McMahon leaving the building at the end of the night and being greeted at the limousine by her husband, Triple H, who made his first appearance on TV, on non-NXT television for the first time since he turned on Seth Rollins, and still has yet to give us an explanation of why. So they put that footage up on their YouTube channel. They put that on their website. That did not air on the pay-per-view. And so there you go. That was Clash of Champions last weekend. There was some big breaking news on WWE.com a couple days ago. They have announced that the 2017 Royal Rumble, which had been rumored for Los Angeles but not confirmed, is not going to be in LA. In fact, it's going to be back at the Alamo Dome in San Antonio, Texas, January 29th, that's the 20-year anniversary of the last time they brought the Royal Rumble to San Antonio at the Alamo Dome. And I remember that show because it's to this day the only Royal Rumble to be held in some sort of a dome or a stadium setting. It's a big, big building. You could fit over 70,000 people in there. I know this because I remember when they were promoting that Rumble back in 97. It was Shawn Michaels' homecoming, right? Shawn Michaels was the big superstar, San Antonio native, and he was trying to get his championship back from Psycho Sid. And I remember them doing, it was like a backstage sit-down promo with him, and he mentioned the fact, you know, there's going to be 72,000 people in that building. They kept throwing that 72,000 number out there. And I remember when the show actually came and they gave the attendance, they put it up on the screen, it was 60,000, which is still very impressive. But it wasn't 72,000. I think they were hoping to get a lot more people in that building. As it is, I remember reading about how that was it was heavily papered. It was by no means 60,000 paid attendance. They couldn't give tickets away fast enough to try to fill that building. I don't know. The paid was probably like 40-something thousand. Still a big crowd. You know, still a big crowd. But also, you know, business at that point, like late 96, early 97, business by no means was booming. For WWE, they were kind of in a rut. They didn't really break out of that until later in 97. So still, to get 60,000 people in the building is pretty impressive. Can they do that this time? You know, it's hard to say. This is the first time they've done this with a non-WrestleMania show in a long, long, long time. And I like it. I would actually like to see them do more of it, to be honest with you. I'd like to have them do more non-Mania shows in domes. I don't know about stadiums, but do it in like a big dome. They have the Georgia Dome in Atlanta. They have these different buildings that can fit 40, 50,000 people. To me, I get, you know, it makes WrestleMania feel more special. But yeah, you can do WrestleMania in the outdoor stadiums and save a SummerSlam or save a Rumble every now and then for a big building like this. I was a little concerned that maybe they were going to do what TNA did a number of years ago. TNA actually brought one of their pay-per-views to the Alamo Dome, which is just unbelievable to even think that they did this. But what they did was they basically curtained off like 80% of the building or whatever. So they had probably even more than that. I don't know what the actual attendance was, but it was so minuscule. But it's like, why even run that building? Why, TNA of all companies, and we're going to talk about them here in a second, why would you even think about running the Alamo Dome? But they did. But WWE is, they're already talking about, you know, they had 60,000 all those years ago, and they wouldn't be mentioning that if they weren't going to try to fill that building. So I think it's cool. I'd like to see them do more of it, and frankly, I think it's also high time the UK got a show like this, whether it's Wembley Stadium. I don't know if they have a really big indoor building there in the UK somewhere that has like a 30 or 40,000 capacity. If not, then do it at Wembley or do it at some place like that. I think it's high time. With the network now too, it doesn't have to be WrestleMania. You can almost do like a trial run. Take a SummerSlam. Look, I'm happy SummerSlam's in New York. I love this whole 3 day in a row thing. We get NXT, we get SummerSlam, we get Raw. I went to all three shows this year. That's where we did our meetup. It's a lot of fun. I know they're coming back to New York next year. You know, I'd love for them to come to New York every year for SummerSlam. But I also think it would be really cool if they wanted to have this like SummerSlam returns to Wembley or somewhere in the UK. And the UK crowds can be very, very lively and a lot of fun to watch. And I think if they got a big pay-per-view like that, I think that they would really make that special. So you got the network now. Maybe they just add another show to the schedule. Although now, you know, they've got 19 pay-per-views now. You got two pay-per-views with this brand split every single month. All of a sudden, it's like I was such a big fan of those network specials. They had Roadblock and they had the Beast in the East special. And I love that, and I wanted them to do more of it. And now it's like, do we really even need specials like that? They're so oversaturated now with pay-per-views. I think the last thing I want is more shows. I think they've killed it. I don't know if I want that anymore. But if they ever do it, I think they ought to bring one to the UK, because I think it's long overdue for them to go back there. Best wishes to Jamie Noble. This is a sad story. Pro Wrestling, she broke it during the week. He was stabbed twice in a trailer park in West Virginia. He was coming home from a WWE show. He, of course, still works for them as an agent. And some guy, I guess, followed him there, claiming that Noble cut him off on the road, and Noble tried to apologize and kind of defuse the situation. It got physical, though. Noble took the guy down. There were two or three other men that jumped out of the other guy's car. One of them stabbed Noble twice in the back. Literally stabbed him in the back. He was taken to the ER. I have seen no update on his condition since then, other than I think he may have been moved out of the ER. I hope he's okay. That's all I can say. I would assume... I shouldn't assume anything. Just because we haven't heard anything doesn't mean he's not in a bad way. I hope he's okay. I hope they find the guys who did this, and they lock them in a room with Brock Lesnar and Stephanie McMahon. Clearly the two toughest people in all of WWE. I'll talk about the presidential debate later in the show. People wanted me to give my thoughts on it, so I'm going to save that for later because there is just too much to go through here with all of this TNA stuff. This whole TNA situation is such a mess. I mean, I don't even know where to begin. I guess we can start with the fact that as I record this, okay, I am recording this here on Sunday morning, they're having their Bound for Bankruptcy pay-per-view tonight. There were questions all week about whether or not there would even be a show, but according to the New York Post, they have secured the necessary cash to fund, not only tonight's show, but the next set of TV tapings, apparently, and those tapings would take them through the month of December. It's like TNA is like a little cockroach. It's like a cockroach. It just won't die. It will never die. At this rate, I am convinced that this company will outlive all of us. So let's just back up a little bit here, because there are a lot of you listening who probably are out of the loop on exactly what the hell is going on here. So what happened here? What happened is that Billy Corgan stepped in at the last minute, the last second a few months ago. By his own admission, the ink was still drying on the paper while he was walking to the ring. He had funded the last set of TV tapings because TNA had no money. Big shock. They had no money left. And so in doing so, what happened there was he was able to buy himself, because he had them by the balls, he bought himself an ownership stake in the company. And that was when they made the announcement that he was taking over as the president of TNA. Dixie Carter was no longer the president. Billy Corgan was now the president of TNA. So he replaced Dixie as the president of TNA, or I guess Impact Ventures now is the formal name of the company or the parent company. Maybe it's like that whole Titan Sports, WWF thing where Titan Sports was the parent company. I guess now here it's Impact Ventures. Whatever the case is, all that did was it bought them some more time. They needed money to fund the tapings. Billy stepped in, ponied up the money, and it bought them a stay of execution. That's all that did. Now, at the time, there were a lot of reports on these different sites that, well, that's the end of Dixie Carter. Dixie Carter no longer has any affiliation with TNA. She's out of the picture. She's gone. Not true. Creatively, maybe. She has no input there, but she still owns, from what I've seen reported, up to 70% of the company. Certainly, whatever the number is, she owns a majority interest still in this company. So her and Billy Corgan are not the only ones, though, that have ownership stakes. There are other parties involved here, so that complicates things. Fast forward now to this past week, when all of this news broke about TNA and how this could be the end. And so you fast forward to this week, and TNA once again finds itself in big trouble because they didn't have enough money. Surprise, surprise! They didn't have enough money to fund their biggest pay-per-view of the year and the TV tapings that are supposed to be taking place in Orlando this week. And Billy Corgan, he's at the point now, he's not a dumb guy, he's at the point now where he's not about to sink in his own money. This is his money that he's using. He's not, you know, he doesn't have a benefactor. This is his money. And he is not about to sink his own money into the company again unless he takes full ownership. He wants 100% control of TNA. If he's going to put his own money into this, he wants to know that he owns it, it's his, he controls it, and he can take it to wherever he wants it to go. He could take the company in the direction that he wants to take it in. Enter WWE. New York Post, they did a story a week ago claiming WWE was interested in purchasing TNA. To do what with it? It didn't say. To me, there's no way WWE buys TNA and keeps it running. Because why would they do that? What incentive is there? TNA is not a hot brand. TNA is not this well-known global brand. It's existed for 14 years. They have their loyal fan base. But it's not like TNA has this pedigree or this reputation as being this great, successful, big, hot wrestling company. They don't. There is no incentive for WWE to keep TNA running as its own separate company. You could say, well, they could just put it on the network. But they've already got NXT. They've got their own things. I mean, do you really want to start to muddy the waters that way? I mean, look, in a way, if WWE wanted to take a different approach with its network, and they wanted to reach agreements with all of these independent promotions and evolve, or I don't know, I mean, there's so many of them now. But let's lump TNA in there. And they're going to air some of these different products and shows on their network. You know, in a way, I guess that might be kind of cool, but that's not what they're doing. But that's not what they're doing here. And again, I would question, so you're going to run this company as a separate entity, right? You just started your own brand split. So you have these unique teams that are running Raw and SmackDown now, and the brand split so far, I don't want to say it's been a bust. It's only been a couple of months, but this brand split ain't lighting the world on fire, okay? And I was not a fan of it to begin with, and I can tell you right now that I'm no bigger a fan of it now than I was a few months ago, but you got to give it time. Fine. But they're doing their own brand split. It's almost like they're running their own separate brands. They still have NXT. I know they just wrapped up the Cruiserweight Classic, which actually was better than all of it. And why would they keep these people in power running TNA and have to manage all of that? It's just another headache for them. It doesn't make any sense. It's not really making them any money. let's be honest here. It's not going to make them this great fortune that makes it worth their while to keep TNA solvent and running as is. So if WWE buys it, they're going to shut it down. They're going to grab the tape library. They're going to grab whoever they want to grab. There's a lot of talent in TNA. There's a lot of guys in TNA that I would love to see go back or go to WWE for the first time. But that's what they would do. That's what I would do. You know, TNA, I've said it a million times, and here's the other aspect to all this. TNA, it's a poison brand. It has been so greatly diminished and damaged over the years that unless you renamed it, which Billy Corgan, by the way, said he would do, this guy's got a plan, and part of his plan is to rebrand because he realizes the same thing. Unless you rename it and you change everything about it to wipe out the stain of those TNA initials, there's no point in WWE trying to keep this thing alive. Supposedly, they made an offer. It was a lowball offer. Billy Corgan made the rounds. He did a few interviews. He pretty much said that, look, if Vince McMahon really wants it, he's going to get it because I can't compete with Vince McMahon. Nobody can compete with Vince McMahon. If he got a bug up his butt and he wanted TNA in the worst way, he's going to get it. There's nobody's going to come along and outbid him for it. So he flat out admits that. But he made it very clear he wants to be the one to own TNA. He's dipping into his own money here, all of his Smashing Pumpkins money. He's got a vision for where TNA needs to go, but he's not willing to invest anymore unless he knows he's got the keys to the castle. Otherwise, look, I mean, where's the return on this guy's investment? It's like flushing his money down the toilet every 2 or 3 months. He knows by just throwing money at this thing every few months, it's like putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound. It does nothing to fix their problems. Just buys them some more time. People haven't been paid. I mean, there's a lot of other issues here, by the way. TNA, it has accrued a lot of debt over the years that has yet to be paid. People haven't been paid. We've heard these stories before, but that includes vendors. They want their money. Anyone who buys the company, I would assume, would be assuming those debts as well. There's pending lawsuits still against the company. I know Eric Bischoff still has litigation pending against them. It's a very complicated, very messy situation. And it's all thanks to one person. And that person is Dixie Carter. Dixie Carter, with her majority interest in the company, is at a position now where she holds the fate of TNA in her hands. If you remember when Vince McMahon bought WCW and that final Nitro opened, and it was a shot of Vince McMahon, he cupped his hand out, he said, "I now hold the fate of WCW in my hands." Well, that's the position that Dixie Carter is now with her own company. More so now than ever. If you listen to what Billy Corgan said in those interviews, and you read between the lines, you can tell that he was trying to send a message. He was trying to, in a way, the way I heard it, it was almost like he was trying to force her hand here. He was impatient. He wants this to move along. He wants to own the company, but he can't because it's out of his hands. It's out of his control. And it's Dixie who really holds all the cards. And it was almost like he was trying to, by going public with this, force her hand in a sense to just make a move and do what's best for TNA. And the thing is, what's best for TNA is not necessarily what's best for Dixie Carter. Because if she can get herself, let's say, a sweetheart deal from WWE and walk away from the whole thing, then why not? Why not take the money and run? But I also get the sense with all of these stories and the interviews that Corgan did, he and she, the two of them, they may not be huge fans of each other. Dixie may not have a great deal of fondness for Billy Corgan. I don't know that, but that's kind of my sense. And so you get the sense that there's some politicking going on here, which just makes things even more complicated. And the really shitty thing, you want to know the shitty thing? I mean, it's shitty for the fans. There are still TNA fans out there that will live and die with this company. And I worry about them, depending on how this next few days goes. But the ones who really get kind of screwed over by this are the wrestlers, because by all accounts, they don't know what's going on. Nobody is keeping them in the loop. And this is the story of TNA, isn't it? How many times have we heard these stories about There's some question about the ownership of the company. Are they going to have enough money for the tapings? All these rumors, what's going to happen? I feel like we go through this every few months, and every single time we hear from, you know, the, I don't want to call them disgruntled, but, you know, a lot of the TNA talent will speak to a Mike Johnson from PW Insider, or maybe a Jason Powell from ProWrestling.net, or a Dave Meltzer, or whoever, because they don't know what's going on. And when the wrestlers don't know what's going on, they call up people or they email people who probably know more than they do. And those people that I just mentioned, whether it's Meltzer or Johnson or Dave Scherer or whoever, those guys should not know more about what's going on here than the people who work for TNA. So it's really shitty that the wrestlers are kept in the dark on all this because they don't know if they're going to have a job or not. They don't know what's going to happen. I mean, think about it. You got a lot of guys who left WWE, who did not want to work there anymore. Cody Rhodes is about to make his debut tonight for TNA. Drew Galloway, all of these people, some of whom maybe didn't leave WWE on the best of terms, and some of them I'm sure would love to go back. But these guys came over to TNA because they had to get away from WWE, or maybe WWE didn't want them. You know, they let Damian Sandow go, and now he landed on his feet in TNA. And imagine what must be going through their minds to hear all these rumors and stories. And forget the wrestling websites. Just pick up the New York Post. I mean, you can say a lot of things about the New York Post, but, you know, their business section is pretty, you know, it's pretty well respected. And you've got stories in their business section that say, well, WWE's involved in the negotiations. And they read this, and they've heard nothing from Dixie Carter. They've heard nothing from anybody in the company, and they don't know what's going on. Imagine what must be going through their minds. But the tale of Dixie Carter, it's an interesting one. She has a very interesting story. Now, I would say this right off the bat, because you could say a lot of things about Dixie Carter. I've said a lot of things about Dixie Carter. Let's just be clear about one thing here. Without Dixie Carter, there is no TNA right now. If she never steps in and convinces her father to invest in the company, TNA would have been dead in year one. They would not have gotten out of that birth year. They would have been done. So she deserves credit for that. And I think she deserves credit for somehow keeping this company alive as long as she has. Somehow, TNA has managed to outlive both WCW and ECW. Two companies that have been dead for 15 years and yet still are more popular than TNA. People still long for the days of WCW. People still chant ECW at shows. 15 years from now, I guarantee you, believe me, people will not be chanting for TNA. And yet somehow, they soldier on. She's kept the company alive. And yet, you have countless stories of mismanagement, incompetence under her watch. The Daphne story from many years ago that I ripped them to shreds for in episode 156. The late payments to talent and to their production staff. Her unwavering support for so many years for Vince Russo, which was so mind-boggling. It made me wonder if he had naked photos of her that he was using as blackmail to keep his job. Bringing in Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff, which turned out great for them, didn't it? She was this close at one point to bringing in Paul Heyman. Heyman had a plan all laid out for how he would fix TNA, but she wouldn't give him what he wanted, and that killed the whole deal. And who knows? Who knows how different things might have turned out with Heyman as the creative force behind TNA? Then there's this whole email debacle between Dixie and Russo. Nobody knows how to use fucking email in that company. They're sending emails to all the wrong people. I mean, the one story with Dixie, she accidentally copies the president of Destination America, okay, their own TV partner, the very network that they air on. She copies him and a bunch of other executives and openly insults them. Calls them dummies, I think, or something like that. And eventually, of course, that gets them kicked off the network, because who the hell would want to work with somebody like that? Then there's the Toby Keith story, right? Big-time musician, lots of money, he's interested in buying. I think Jeff Jarrett was involved in bringing the two sides together. They have a meeting at Toby Keith's house with Dixie and her dad. Toby Keith is ready to sign on the dotted line, and Bob Carter is insistent that any deal they reach, Got to protect Dixie. Dixie has to be involved, with, even just if it's just an on-air TV role. She's got to save face. She's got to be involved somehow. And Toby Keith just says, no way. And he walks away. All because Dixie Carter just had to save face. That was more important to her and her family than making a deal that I think, you know, I mean, who the hell knows what would have happened, right? Toby Keith's never ran a wrestling company before, but he sure has a lot of money. And he could put people in power that at least have some sense of what they're doing. I think that could have really lifted that company out of a giant hole that they were in at the time. But it was more important that Dixie save face. I mean, Jim Ross is friends with Toby Keith. He wrote about this on his blog. He said it himself. The man wanted full control, no restrictions, and they wouldn't give it to him. Which brings us to today. What does she do? She's been tweeting, Dixie has, the last few days about some big surprises on the way. Supposedly WWE was in and out. Now they were in, now they're out again of the negotiations. There was another New York Post story. They may be back in WWE, according to that story. But they're not the ones funding the shows this weekend. I mentioned at the top, they somehow found that this cash infusion, Bound for Bankruptcy, the tapings this week, it sounds like it's on. It sounds like it's going to happen. I mean, I'm recording this on a Sunday morning, so a lot of you are going to be listening to this, and you're going to know. I mean, by then, you're probably listening to this right now, and maybe we already have all the answers. Maybe we already have a new owner. Maybe this is all outdated by then. But WWE is not the one funding these shows. Billy Corgan, by all accounts, I don't believe he's the one. This is according to the New York Post. And their sources, whoever these sources are, they're speculating that the money is coming from a mystery third party. Speculating being the key word there. They actually use that word in the article. But it sounds like, you know, even this person, whoever it is that talked to the Post, even they don't really know what the hell's going on here. They did say WWE had no comment, which I thought was very telling, because if this was all bullshit and WWE just didn't want to have anything to do with TNA and didn't want to have anything to do with any of this nonsense, they would just say, hey, we're not involved. And the fact that they're not doing that, I think, is very telling. So, as I said before, it's very, very possible that by the time many of you listen to this, we'll have all of our answers. I mean, hell, they may reveal the fate of TNA on the pay-per-view tonight. Maybe that's what they're waiting for. Maybe they're going to make a big announcement. Dixie will come out or Corgan will come out during the pay-per-view. And they'll settle this and they'll make an announcement about the fate of TNA. The talent, supposedly, is behind Billy. They'd like to see him get it. Corgan at least seems to have a vision for where he wants to take this place, you know, this company. I'd like to see him get full power. You know, as far as how I would like to see this shake out, I'd like to see Billy Corgan get a shot at it. I listen to him in those interviews, and you know, the one thing is he's a wrestling fan. He's been a wrestling fan for a long time. He's putting his own money into this. He's not a stupid person. If he's got a vision for where this can go, and one of TNA's biggest problems has been money, and if he is in a position to kind of take care of that for a while so they don't need to worry about that and they can focus on other things, then maybe that's the way to go. And if he's going to rebrand the entire company like he says he wants to, he's going to give them a chance. You know what? Let's see what he can do. Let's see what he can do. But if it lives, if TNA finds a way to live another day like they seem to always find a way, it has to be without Dixie Carter. Okay, she's kept it alive this long, but TNA at this point, you know how I'd describe it? TNA at this point is the equivalent of a kidnap victim chained to some dude's basement, chained to the wall in some guy's basement, right? They're feeding him. They're feeding him to keep him alive, but he's still chained to the wall. He ain't getting any better. He's being kept alive, but for what? Dixie is holding this thing hostage right now. She needs to collect her ransom and let the hostage go. And that way, everybody walks away happy. Raw this past Monday was live from Cincinnati, Ohio. Raw Instapoll up on my Twitter page. Over 1,800 of you voted. 29% thumbs up, 71% thumbs down. Ouch. And also, speaking of ouch, 1.75 rating. Down from last week's pretty abysmal 1.97. That would make it the lowest number in the history of the show. Still good for 2.5 million viewers overall, which is actually much better than I thought it would do, to be honest with you. I think if anything, this tells us what the base is. I think we have a pretty good sense now of what their base is. But this week is a number you could throw away. I mean, you had the presidential, I mean, besides football, you had the debate. That was the big thing, and that did quite a few people. Again, I'm going to talk about the debate later. But Monday Night Football got hit too. Monday Night Football probably got hit harder than Raw did. It dropped something like 30% up against the debate. I mean, we knew the debate would squash everything, and it pretty much did. Raw will almost definitely be back up this week. The question is by how much. They had better hope those people come back and did not come to the realization that they have Love and Hip Hop as an alternative on TV. So, between them knowing that they were going to get killed in the ratings, and the fact that Seth Rollins hurt his ribs the night before, there's a gutbuster spot at the pay-per-view, and he got hurt. He didn't break his ribs, but whatever they may have had planned for him on this show apparently had to be changed. Between those two things, it made for a very boring show. This was not a strong effort at all. They opened with a 30-minute U.S. title match, okay, between Roman Reigns and Rusev, that ended on a double countout. A 30-minute match should never end on a double countout. Not unless they brawl into the street or something creative like that. See, that might actually be kind of cool. They don't do stuff like that. If they brawl through the crowd and then back into the ring. But no, they didn't do that. They brawled into the crowd. They got counted out. Then they brawled back to ringside. Rusev hit Reigns in the ribs with a chair when, you know, he went for the Superman punch. Reigns sold it, which is ridiculous to me because the dude is wearing a protective vest, right? He's wearing body armor. I don't know why it hurt him so much. Anyway, he put Roman in the ring. Roman gave him a spear. So then Roman takes the chair, right? Rusev is down. He sets the chair down. He sits in the chair, which the crowd boos him for because they wanted him to beat the piss out of this guy with this chair. But no, he sits in the chair, gets booed, and then when Rusev starts to move, then he gets up and he gives him one chair shot and he leaves. I think Roman Reigns needs to read the crowd a little bit better because that's not what they wanted to see. Mick Foley made his first of many appearances on this show. Many, many, many appearances. Raw could really take a lesson, I think, from SmackDown on the GM stuff where less is more. So first, he called out Sheamus and Cesaro after their draw at Clash of Champions. Yes, the Best of Seven series ended in a draw. He said it was impossible to determine who the better man was, you know, because God forbid you should have, like, you know, one more match or something. It's impossible, he said. Can't determine who the better man is. And so because he promised the winner a championship opportunity, he was granting them both a championship opportunity at the tag team titles. And if that sounds familiar to you, I got to give a shout out to Nick. Nick was the one who sent that idea into the podcast a few weeks back. People did not like this at all. He said they would face the winner of the next match between Anderson and Gallows and the New Day. New Day now on day 400 here on the show as the tag team champions, which gave some people, even myself, I was thinking, okay, they hit 400. Maybe tonight's the night. Maybe tonight they're going to drop the belts to Anderson and Gallows. Nope. Apparently they're going for the record, only 79 more days as of this show to break Demolition's record. I'm pretty sure Demolition's record is 478 days, if I'm not mistaken. So anyway, it was Anderson and Gallows. I'll give you one guess as to what happened. They lost, of course. Again, Trouble in Paradise by Kofi. Kofi came up bloody after he got thrown into the ring steps. I mean, his face was just covered in blood. I think he needed like 9 stitches to close. There was like a cut above his eye. Sheamus and Cesaro then were backstage. They're arguing some more. Mick Foley shows up again. This is his second appearance now. He launched himself into this passionate promo about how great both of these guys were and how he believes they can change the face of tag team wrestling. I'm going to stay on the Foley thing right now before we get into all the other segments because this leads into a bigger point I want to make here. Okay, Foley then made his third appearance on the show later in a backstage, what I would call character assassination segment with Stephanie McMahon. Foley begins to question Stephanie about her meeting with Triple H after the show the night before, right? Well, he was busy. He was busy, Foley was. He was tending to Sheamus and Cesaro. They had both been left hurt after their match. He found it very convenient that Stephanie would send a second referee down to the ring just at the right moment in the main event to help give Kevin Owens the win over Seth Rollins. And with that, let the emasculation begin. She tells Foley the main event wasn't what it should have been. It was all his fault. While you were busy checking on Sheamus and Cesaro, you weren't doing your job, and so I had to do your job for you. That's what I pay our doctors for, she says. That's not your job to check on them. That's the doctor's job. You need to use your brain and not your heart and not make baseless accusations against me. And poor Foley, okay, this guy, the one-time hardcore legend, Mick Foley, is reduced to a sad sack and practically begs this woman not to fire him. She threatens, I'm going to demote you from GM to ambassador. Is that what you want me to do? He's like, no, of course, Stephanie. No, I don't want that. I don't want that. Well, then you better start doing your job. And with that, Mick Foley picked his nuts up off the floor and shuffled off. He made a fourth appearance. Later in the show, he confronted Seth Rollins backstage when he got to the building. Seth wanted to get at Kevin Owens and Chris Jericho for what they did to him the night before. Foley said, you're not medically cleared. I can't let you. And Rollins was very upset after seeing Stephanie get into the limo with Triple H the night before. And Foley tries to explain things to him, and Rollins just goes, all I hear coming out of your mouth right now is Stephanie McMahon's words. And he walks off, and again, Foley is standing there just looking like a sad child. I say this as someone who likes Mick Foley. This general manager stuff has killed him dead. Just killed him dead. That segment with Stephanie was just the nail in the coffin. Wasn't just because of that one segment, but that was the nail in the coffin. This is what Stephanie does, of course. We all know this. She does it with everybody. Rarely does anybody ever get any sort of revenge on her. Okay, Vicky Guerrero did, and that was about it. That's the only time I can really remember somebody getting revenge, and then it's not like Stephanie then came back and got her back. Vicky was leaving. They gave her a nice moment where she knocked Stephanie into a vat of pudding or whatever it was, and Vicky got to go ride off into the sunset. It was very cool for her. She's the only one. The other women aren't safe. It's not just the men. The other women on this show are not safe. Stephanie, okay, she did this with AJ Lee. She did it with Brie Bella. She did it with Charlotte. She did it with Big Show. She did it with Roman Reigns. She did it with Seth Rollins. She did it with John Cena. She did it with Chris Jericho. I could go on and on and on and on. Now she did it with Mick Foley. And the ratings just keep going down, down, down. And these other segments with Foley, it's not just where like he's being browbeaten by her. Even the other segments when they put him in the ring and he's got to, you know, read something or whatever, he seems off. You know, he's out there, he's tripping over his words. And then like in the segment with Cesaro and Sheamus, you know, I guess they said, hey, we want to put these two guys over, cut this passionate promo. He's screaming and shouting, and there's really no reason for him to be screaming and shouting. You know, I mean, again, he was trying to make, I guess, Cesaro and Sheamus as a tag team feel kind of special. But to me, it just rings hollow. I mean, when Mick Foley has got something real good to sink his teeth into, that's when he's at his best. Mick Foley is one of the great storytellers in all of wrestling. That's not the Mick Foley that we've seen since he came back. Add to that the fact how overexposed this guy is. It's only been 2 months, and I'm already sick to death of seeing him on TV. The overexposure is killing this guy. Maybe that's why he's out there sometimes stumbling over his words. I'd stumble over my words too if I had to memorize 5 different things for 5 different segments on this show. I think there's a lesson to be learned from how little we see of Daniel Bryan on SmackDown this week, at least this week. Now, there are some weeks where Bryan's out there a few times, but even then, it's not like he's flooding the show with Daniel Bryan segments. This past week, I don't think he showed up once on the show. William Regal is another great example on NXT. When we see Regal, there's a reason for it. He's not on that show every single week. Or if he is, he's relegated to a backstage segment to make some kind of announcement, like the Dusty Classic when they opened the show with that announcement on Wednesday. He was in the ring before the arena even opened. The trophy was in the ring. He made this great announcement. I mean, if we saw him again on the show, it might have been one backstage segment. That was it. We don't get over, you know, like overwhelmed with William Regal segments every week on TV, which, by the way, would not be the worst thing in the world because it's William Regal. But I think there's a lesson to be learned there. And you know, I go back to July when the brand split was first taking effect, and we didn't know who the general managers were going to be. There was a lot of debate and speculation. And remember, I floated the idea, man, I'd love to see Kurt Angle come back and be the GM on SmackDown, and he can draft this guy and that guy in American Alpha. And I still think that would have been a pretty badass idea. I mean, I like Daniel Bryan and all, but I still feel like it should have been Kurt. But on Raw, I had pitched the idea at one point that, hey, why not make Sting the general manager of Raw? And I still think that could have worked, just in small doses. Thank Christ they didn't make Sting the GM. Can you imagine Sting standing there and letting Stephanie McMahon dress him down like that? Y'all know how I feel about these authority figures and the need for GMs to begin with. I have no use for them. But instead of Mick Foley lifting the show, it's taking Mick Foley down with it, into the abyss. And to me, it's just really sad to see. It's sad to see him reduced to this. And it's even sadder having to watch him bow his head in shame to Stephanie and walk off like some kid who got caught jacking off by his mom. And by the way, he's not doing himself any favors either when he goes on social media, he goes on Twitter, and he goes off on the fans because they booed the ugly red belt, or because instead of talking about what a great match Cesaro and Sheamus had at the pay-per-view, which they did. They did. They had the best match, I thought, on the entire show. But going off on the fans because you're upset over the finish and you're not talking about this great match, this is the same guy who once took a baseball bat to his TV in a show of protest over Daniel Bryan being left out of the Royal Rumble match. So I'm not sure Mick Foley is the person to be lecturing us and to tell the fans to kiss his arse if they don't like the finish of that match. He might not be the best messenger on that. If anybody should understand the frustration that the fans have, it's Mick Foley, because he would lash out before they hired him, of course. He would lash out at the drop of a hat. We had two cruiserweight matches on this show. Rich Swann and Cedric Alexander against Lindsay Dorado and Drew Gulak. I like that they're trying to keep with the presentation of the matches in the CWC. They got the pre-match handshakes, and they got the referee raising the hand at the end of the match. You know, to me, anything to differentiate it from the rest of the show is a good thing. People were making, you know, oh, it's stupid, they got the purple ropes and stuff. I mean, yeah, do they need to be taping up the ropes in different colors just for these matches? They don't have to, but you know what? It's part of the overall presentation, so I'm okay with it. It's fine. Swan with the rich kick cradle to Gulak for the win. I see Drew Gulak. You know, I look at him, and I mean, it's amazing to me because I remember it was earlier this year, I think, I was watching Drew Gulak and Zack Sabre Jr. wrestle at, you know, a few blocks away from where I live, an indie show here. I walked to the show, and I'm watching Drew Gulak and Zack Sabre Jr. go at it, and Tony Nese was on that show, and now I'm watching these guys on Raw. Like, they completely skipped NXT. If you would have told me 6 months or 8 months ago I'd be seeing these guys on Raw, I would have called you crazy. And yet here they are. And Drew Gulak doesn't exactly come off as the kind of person that you would expect them to put on Raw. He just doesn't. But what he reminds me of, the more I watch him, he is, I think, to this cruiserweight division, in a lot of ways, what Dean Malenko was to the WCW cruiserweight division. He's the Iceman. I mean, that's what he is, right? He comes out. He's got this very stoic, very serious look on his face. He's known as a wrestling machine, a wrestling machine, a submission machine. Not a lot of flash there at all, but the dude can go, and he's not somebody that you would want to mess with. So that's kind of the comparison that jumped out at me when I was watching him on Monday. The other match had the Cruiserweight champion TJ Perkins against Tony Nese. Nese did this twisting tope over the top rope, landed on his feet on the floor. I just incredible. It's funny, I call him like a bigger guy because he's so muscular, but he's still a cruiserweight. You know, you got to be under 205. Legit, you got to be under 205 to compete in the cruiserweight division. So, yeah, I mean, he might be bigger than, let's say, a TJ Perkins, but he's still not like that big of a guy, but he kind of looks that way because I think he's just so muscled up. Perkins won with the knee bar. I thought Tony Nese made a great impression here. He looked even better than Perkins did. The fans got bored midway through this match here in this third hour, and they began chanting for CM Punk and Randy Savage. And somebody wrote in and said there was one section that was chanting Chris Benoit, which is, those people can just fuck right off. Look, I'm all for the fans having fun. Savage I could excuse, because come on, it's Randy Savage. The CM Punk stuff I just don't get. I just, you know, he's gone. He's gone. He's not coming back. He doesn't give a fuck about you or your stupid chants. Just let it go. One person tweeted me and said, well, you know, they were chanting these things because nobody knows who these guys are. WWE has to do a better job of giving us a reason to care and explaining who these guys are. I know I'm comparing apples to oranges here because wrestling was hot back then, and these WWE crowds today, like 8 times out of 10, are like cadavers most weeks. But, you know, I don't know. When I would watch the Cruiserweights in WCW, like at the beginning, it's not like the fans knew who fucking Juventud Guerrero was. Eddie Guerrero didn't have this well-defined backstory other than he's part of the Guerrero family. At the beginning, that's all we knew. We didn't know anything else about this guy. But those guys went out there and they put on great matches. And WCW back then, a lot of weeks, they were run, even when they were getting hot and started to whip WWE, they were still running buildings like in Tupelo, Mississippi, and Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Okay, these are hardly places that saw a lot of lucha libre, but they had no problem getting into those matches. The fans weren't shitting on those matches. They weren't bored during those matches. So to me, that excuse, like, I'm all for character development, and I'll agree with you on that when it comes to most other people on the show. You've got to give them a reason to care. Right now, we're in the honeymoon period with these cruiserweights. When people hear cruiserweight, they don't think well-defined stories. I mean, we got a lot of that in the Cruiserweight Classic. I thought they did a tremendous job of giving you a backstory on each person, and like Kendrick, right? The story with him, this is his last chance. The stories on there were tremendous, but we're in the honeymoon phase of this division. And a lot of mainstream fans who maybe do remember WCW, maybe they've never even heard the word cruiserweight before. They don't even know what it is. You're in a position right now, at least in these first like 2 or 3 months, I feel, where people are going to look at this division and they're going to want action. It's not so much about stories. It's not so much about the bullshit gimmicks. It's about these guys going out there at a million miles an hour and putting on an amazing match and making people just clap and go, wow, holy shit, I can't believe what I just saw. At least at the beginning, to me, that's what they need to do. Like, right out of the gate, high energy, high action, get people to look at these guys and just look at them differently than everybody else on the show. You're going to see these guys doing stuff that you won't see R-Truth out there doing, that you won't see Rusev out there doing. It's got to just be fucking balls to the wall. That's what they need to be doing right now. That's what worked in WCW. You didn't have the well-established stories at the beginning. As time went on, you did. And they had they built up feuds with Dean Malenko and Chris Jericho, and there were stories there. Chris Jericho, the conspiracy theory victim, and all that kind of stuff. And there's plenty of time to do that. But I don't buy that argument. Well, they're booing them or they're bored because they don't know much about them. It doesn't matter. Send them out there and let them do their thing. That's how you get people into this. Now, to me, and I don't think I'm using it as a crutch. I really do think there's something here about that third hour, the third hour syndrome. We have yet to see them open a show with a cruiserweight match, which is what I was hoping they would do on week one, and they didn't. And I'm especially after this show, I'm really curious to see if the audience would react the same way they did here. If, let's say, tomorrow night in LA, they open Raw with that they have a championship match, okay, scheduled for tomorrow night. TJ Perkins defending against Brian Kendrick. And, see, that's a bad example because they do have a story there, okay? That's the one match that actually does have a story. And people actually know who Brian Kendrick is, so maybe that's a bad example to use. So maybe they do that match later in the show. Open the show with, like, Jack Gallagher against Akira Tozawa or something like that. Jack Gallagher is awesome, by the way, and I took a look at that guy on day one. I didn't know who he was. He looked like the third vaudevillian to me, and I just had no interest. But when you watch the guy, he's incredible. He got over with me the very first time I saw him wrestle. And I really think you take a guy like that and a guy like Tozawa, or whoever, take two guys that the fans don't know. Put them out there at the very beginning of the show. Let them do their thing. Let's see what happens. Maybe the crowd craps all over it. Maybe they chant boring. Maybe they chant JBL. Or maybe, just maybe, they get into it. I'm very curious to see what would happen. I bet you that they would do pretty well. I think they would get the show off to a hot start. We got a video of Ashton Kutcher and Danny Masterson on Instagram. They were on That 70s Show together. I never watched That 70s Show. I know the bad guy from RoboCop was the father on that show. I know that. I work for Dick Jones! Dick Jones! Love that fucking movie. The original, not the reboot. They're coming to Raw tomorrow. That was the point of all this. They're coming to Raw tomorrow in L.A. They love their celebrities in L.A. They're coming to L.A. They're going to confront Kevin Owens and Chris Jericho. They said that they are better friends than Jericho and Owens are. Now, ordinarily, I would cringe at this, and I would not be looking forward to this celebrity bullshit. But because Chris Jericho and Kevin Owens are involved, and they've had some pretty memorable celebrity moments themselves, right? Jericho with Bob Barker, Kevin Owens powerbombing Machine Gun Kelly, if you can call him a celebrity, off the stage. That was a lot of fun. Because of that, because of who's involved here, I have moderately high hopes that this will actually end up being funny. As long as they can kind of do their thing and the writers don't like get too involved, I think this should be pretty cool, actually. And we had Chris Jericho and Kevin Owens, speaking of them. They did a highlight reel together. They were great, as they always are. I hope they do one of those ride-along shows on the network. I think that'd be pretty cool. Rollins came out. He was held back by security and Mick Foley. Oh, so actually, Foley was out here again. That makes 5 appearances on this show for him. I said 4 before. It was actually 5. See, I can't even keep track anymore. So Cass and Cesaro, Enzo. Cass and Cesaro would be a better team, but probably than him and Sheamus. So Cass and Enzo came out. This led to a match. They took on Jericho and Owens. It was a match. Not much to it. Kevin Owens pinned Enzo with a powerbomb, the heels posed, and that was it. Pretty straightforward stuff. Again, I'm thinking they had something planned with Rollins, but he probably legit was not medically cleared, and so what are you going to do? So tomorrow night, they've got 2 title matches scheduled. Charlotte defends against Sasha Banks. I hope they don't do the title change there. I would hold off. Do it in Boston. Do it in her hometown. Inside of a cell, right? I think that would make it the first Hell in a Cell women's match. I would do it there. And TJ Perkins defends the Cruiserweight Championship against Brian Kendrick. I think they're going to do a title change. I think that we're probably going to get a title change tomorrow night, and then Perkins can chase him for it. SmackDown. SmackDown Live. We only had 3 matches on this show. That's it, just 3. But one of them was excellent, that being the championship match between Dean Ambrose and AJ Styles. I also really liked the segment with Miz and Dolph Ziggler. Any show that features a cameo by Miz's dad is going to be an automatic thumbs up for me. So I really like this show. The one thing I did not care about was the Bray Wyatt-Randy Orton stuff. Orton was backstage. He was searching the bowels of the building for Bray. It was like something out of a horror movie where Orton moved really slow. He was opening doors. And then Eric Rowan would be there kind of hidden in the shadows with a sheet mask and Orton didn't see him. Not knowing what was going to be on the other side of the door every time he opened one up. I would have had him open up one of the doors to reveal the Boogeyman. They bring in Boogeyman for the occasional cameo, right? They could have had him make a cameo here. It would have been kind of funny. Open the door and he's just standing there like... He travels around the country with them, just relegated to the boiler room. I could believe that. So eventually Orton found Bray. He attacked him. Bray ran away. I thought this was just stupid. The Usos and the Ascension against American Alpha, Heath Slater and Rhino. The Usos have new music to match their new heel personas. Heath Slater got a hot tag in this match. A genuinely hot tag. He got the tag and people went nuts. Unfortunately, the Usos attacked his knee the same way they attacked Chad Gable's knee, and they won with the Tequila Sunrise for the submission. Natalya and Carmella beat Naomi and Nikki Bella when Carmella rolled up Nikki for the win. This was... it's really not that good. They had a homecoming celebration for The Miz. He even got a big pyro... explosion, like WrestleMania-esque celebration. They played a great video package for him, very similar to the one they used for him at WrestleMania 27, which is actually one of the all-time great video packages that I think that they've ever done for The Miz, of all people, that year at WrestleMania. This was just really well done. He got the crowd to turn on him pretty easy by insulting LeBron James. This was his hometown, again, Cleveland, so if you're the heel, how do you get people to boo you? Well, you boo the local sports hero. That's an easy way to do it. So he insulted LeBron James. He pointed out his parents, Mr. and Mrs. Miz, were at ringside. I love the Miz's dad. He always looks lost. Like he took a wrong turn on his way to a Grateful Dead concert. But I smile whenever he's on the show. I don't know why. He also pointed out Dolph Ziggler's parents at ringside, as Ziggler is also a hometown guy from Cleveland. He called their son a loser. He said nothing that wasn't true. This brought out Ziggler, who warned him not to talk to his parents. Miz talked about how Dolph just loses and loses and loses. He said his career is embarrassing. His parents should be ashamed and embarrassed for him. Ziggler wanted one more match against Miz. So now he's stealing Christian's gimmick. Miz said, Dolph, you got nothing to offer me. Unless you're going to do something like put your career on the line or something, you have nothing to offer me, and so I'm out of here. And he went to leave. But he, you know, the line about how unless you put your career on the line, he kind of threw it out there very flippantly. But he goes to leave, and Ziggler tells him to stop. He says, you know what, Miz, you're right. He said, sometimes things you love in life, they don't love you back. He looks at his own career. He admits, I'm not where I want to be. I didn't achieve the things I wanted to achieve. At this point, I thought he was going to pull out a gun and blow his brains out. I was starting to get worried for the guy. But he said, you know, people come up to me all the time. They wonder, why do you keep doing it? Why do you keep subjecting yourself to all of this just pain? People come up to me and they say the same thing to me about Raw, and I don't have an answer for them. All the humiliation, why don't you just quit and go do something else? He says, but I can't. I love it too much. I can't help myself. And this is where Ziggler offered to put his career on the line against Miz's championship. Miz wanted to make sure he was not mishearing what Ziggler had just said. He says, okay, if I beat you, you're done for good. This is not where you're going to go to Raw or you're going to go to NXT or something. If I beat you, you're done. And Ziggler said yes, and Miz accepted. So at No Mercy, it will be Miz and Dolph Ziggler. One final time, title versus career. I like this a lot because, you know, A, I thought the verbal stuff was real good. And B, we got to see Mr. Miz. And C, there's finally an end in sight for this feud, right? This can't possibly go beyond No Mercy. This has to be it, right? Please tell me I'm right. This has to be it. Main event was Dean Ambrose and AJ Styles for the WWE title with John Cena on commentary. This was the best Dean Ambrose match I've seen in a long time. He punched Cena while he was outside the ring near the end. Cena tried to get into the ring to go after him. The referee stopped him. Ambrose had Styles pinned, though, but there was no referee. And so finally, when the ref turns around, Styles kicks out. So this time, Ambrose goes outside the ring. He clobbers Cena for costing him the match. Goes back in. Styles rolls him up while holding the, I was going to say tights, but Ambrose doesn't wear tight jeans. He grabbed a handful of jeans and he got the pin. And Cena gets into the ring, gets up in Dean's face. Ambrose went for dirty deeds. Cena reversed it into the AA. He laid out AJ Styles with the AA. He posed with the championship. He teased the idea of tying 16 titles next Sunday, which he won't. But this was a good show. Talking Smack after was even better. Cena was on Talking Smack. He cut this tremendous promo on Dean Ambrose that just, it burned so much, Ambrose needed a gauze bandage by the time Cena was done with him. I'm going to play about 60 seconds or so. This was the free clip from this that they put up on the WWE Twitter page. It was the part that I think hit home the most, especially the part where he basically says Ambrose hasn't had the same level of success that Roman and Seth have had so far in WWE. So let me play this clip here from Talking Smack.
Dean Ambrose doesn't like John Cena. John Cena doesn't care about Dean Ambrose. And if Dean wants me to care about him, at No Mercy, he'll either step up or step aside. And that's it. Here's a guy legit cashed in a suitcase to win a championship, won a match, and then lost it. And you want to go way back? Document the Shield. The first time they hit the ring, man, Matt Ambrose is something special. Right now, two bona fide WWE superstars, Seth Rollins, Roman Reigns. One guy still trying to figure it out, Dean Ambrose. And yes, he had a great match tonight, but I'm sorry to plug Raw. How many great matches has Cesaro had?
Tons.
Tons. Absolutely tons. And he's still trying to figure it out. And that's not a knock on Dean Ambrose because I know he's going to hopefully put in the work to get better.
Every now and then I am reminded of why John Cena, despite all the corny stuff that he's been out there saying for years, is still probably the best mic guy in that entire company. That was good stuff. Actually, Ambrose and Cena both, I think, deserve a lot of credit. They've done some of their best mic work on this show, on Talking Smack. And honestly, between this show and SmackDown itself, I'm wondering why I even bother watching Raw anymore.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
first female referee ever in NXT debuted this weekend at the NXT live event, I think in Orlando. Nikan is her name. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. She's been a referee in Japan for a number of years. If she were hired, and I don't know if this was a tryout, I don't know if she's officially signed, but it would make her the first full-time female referee in WWE since Rita Marie in the mid-80s. Rita Marie was, her real name was Rita Chatterton. She was the woman who accused Vince McMahon of raping her in the back of his limo back in the 80s. Which was a case that went nowhere. The only female referees they've had since then, yeah, they had Stephanie ref, I think, once or twice, Lita, Sable, Jackie, but, you know, none of them worked full-time. William Regal has announced the second annual Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic, which will be a 16-man, or 16-team, I should say, single elimination tournament with the winners crowned at the next TakeOver show in Toronto next month. They've announced these teams so far. I guess there's more to come, but so far, and this was the biggest surprise of all of them, Kota Ibushi and Hideo Itami are going to be a tag team. That was a surprise. I get the sense that Kota Ibushi, he doesn't know what he wants. You know, he doesn't want to sign a contract with them full-time, which is probably the only reason he didn't win that Cruiserweight Classic. But here he is. He's already back. So, look, hey, I'll take some Kota Ibushi over no Kota Ibushi. But I just think it's funny because everybody just said, okay, well, he's gone for a while. He's going back to Japan, and I guess he is working some matches in Japan, but he's coming in for this. Tino Sabatelli and Riddick Moss are going to be a team. Bobby Roode and Ty Dillinger. Andrade Cien Almas and Cedric Alexander. And Antonio sent me a tweet from the NXT House Show in Lakeland, Florida a few days ago, and all he said was, the Cien Almas heel turn is in effect. He didn't tell me why. He didn't tell me what that means. But that may give a hint as to where they're going here. TM61 is in the tournament. The Bollywood Boys, Johnny Gargano and Tommaso Ciampa, and the Revival. So those are the teams announced so far for the Dusty Classic. Here on this show, Ty Dillinger beat Angelo Dawkins in the opener. Bobby Roode came out to greet Dillinger up on stage after the match. He said, yeah, you're pretty good. You're pretty good. Not quite glorious, but you're pretty good. He said the number one reason that he came to NXT was to win the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic. I'm going to call him a liar on that one. The fans started chanting Glorious 10, and Dillinger ended up shaking his hand and accepting his offer to be tag partners in the tournament. I still say that they end up losing probably early, maybe even in their first match, and it leads to a singles match between them at TakeOver. Just a guess. I don't know what their plans are, but that would be my best guess. But man, I still wish they would have given us Aries and Roode as a team here in this thing. I mean, just think about it. Aries and Roode against Johnny Gargano and Tommaso Ciampa in Toronto. Imagine that. That would have been a pretty badass final. Come on. But actually, I guess them against Ibushi and Itami would probably make more sense given that Aries is feuding with Itami right now. Hey, that would have been a hell of a match too. Kota Ibushi and Hideo Itami against Austin Aries and Bobby Roode. Sign me up. The Ely brothers, they made their debut here on NXT. They are these two giant identical twins who looked at least semi-imposing on their way to the ring. I thought they might actually be there for a squash. Little did I know it turned out to be their own. They were set to battle the Revival. Samoa Joe blew right past them as they were walking to the ring. He got in there. He destroyed both twins all by himself. He then told William Regal, give me Nakamura or give me my title, give me liberty or give me death. No, I just I added that part in myself. No, he was pissed. He was definitely pissed. Dan Matha, we were told, is making his debut next week. He's the big jacked up guy, ex-football player I talked about last week. Ember Moon against Mandy Rose. Mandy Rose is very attractive. She's got that going for her. And I will say this, her first singles match here on NXT, she didn't do half bad. She actually might be a more coordinated, athletic version of Eva Marie. Corey Graves goes nuts. It's literally, they treat her like Eva Marie. She comes out, Corey Graves goes nuts, like he used to for Eva. But I think if she is a more graceful, more coordinated version of Eva, then I think she'll probably do very well for herself because she doesn't have to worry about anything as far as the looks department. She looks like a star. I do find it amusing that Josh and Sarah Lee, who actually won that season of Tough Enough that she appeared on, right? The two people that actually got the big fat contracts, they have yet to make an appearance on NXT television. And yet, Mandy Rose and Patrick Clark, they've already been on TV now multiple times. Top rope stunner by Ember Moon here for the win. The Authors of Pain killed two jobbers dead in what I thought was a fun squash. The more I see of these guys, the more I enjoy them. They really are the closest thing. I mean, forget the Paul Ellering thing. Obviously, that's more of a direct link. But to me, they are the closest thing to a modern-day Road Warriors that we have, just without the face paint and without the cool shoulder pads. They destroyed these two guys. And we finally heard from Paul Ellering after the match. He finally spoke. First time the guy said anything in what, 3 months? And what do the fans do when he finally starts speaking? They start up with that fucking what chant. Yeah, I wish these people, when they let them into Full Sail, the ones that chant what, I don't mind, I really don't mind anything else, but just that chant. I wish these people had little electroshock things taped to their balls so that when they start up with that what chant, somebody in the back, like Triple H, is sitting there watching on the monitor, he could just hit a button and they get shocked. Ellering didn't say much, only that the first chapter began with their arrival, and the next chapter will unleash a plethora of pain. For now, he said that's all you need to know. A man of few words. Maybe we can convince them to replace Mick Foley with Paul Ellering as the Raw GM. Asuka and Liv Morgan. Liv's been talking a lot of shit about Asuka for the last few weeks. She wasn't talking shit after this match. As quickly as it started, it ended. Asuka submitted her in a really painful-looking armbar-type hold. She was trying to pull her shoulder out. So Liv tapped. After the match, Asuka declared, "Nobody is ready for Asuka." I think Ember Moon might have something to say about that pretty soon. Hideo Itami against Lince Dorado was our main event. Real good match. Itami won with the GTS. Austin Aries attacked Itami after. Then he ran off when Itami went to fight back. And so next week, it's Cedric Alexander and Andrade Cien Almas against the Revival in a Dusty Classic match. I like this week's show. First NXT show, I will admit, in a few weeks that I've liked. It's been not doing much for me. I think the tournament coming is the right thing. I think it's coming at just the right time. Because ever since Brooklyn, things have just been dull. This show has just been in the doldrums. But I think the Dusty stuff will probably help spice things up a little bit. Lucha Underground. I have a note here from Kevin, one of our listeners. Kevin wrote in after listening to the Lucha Underground review on last week's podcast. He wanted to clarify a few things. First of all, the Ricky that I mentioned who walked into Dario Cueto's office last week was actually Ricky Mandel. I did not know that. He's been on the show a few times. And also, I did not know this, the Trios tag title match with Jack Evans acting like a giant spoiled brat, that was apparently taped near the end of Season 3. Jack Evans broke his jaw midway through the season and had his jaw wired shut. And so he was very limited in what he could do, which, you know, that would explain it. In fact, if you noticed, on this week's show, he didn't do too much. He wrestled, but he didn't do much, and he never said a word. The one thing Jack Evans is always doing when he comes out, whether it's just yelling at the fans or on the mic, he's always talking shit. He didn't say a word. He's always running his mouth. Not this week. He didn't do it last week. He didn't do it this week. I don't think he opened his mouth once to say anything, which I guess you wouldn't if you had your jaw wired shut. Our show opened with Sinestro de la Muerte, or as I call him, Purple Skeletor, against Prince Puma. Mil Muertes ran down in the middle of the match to go after Puma. Puma sidestepped him, and Mil flew out of the ring. It was kind of funny. Puma then used Mil's flatliner to finish Purple Skeletor for the win, and he made Mil watch. Did not make Mil Muertes very happy at all. Cortez Castro, who was outed as an undercover cop last week by Joey Ryan, he does not know that Dario knows that he's a cop. He was called into Dario's office. Dario gave him a big hug and told him how sorry he was that they lost Francisco, Mr. Cisco. He vowed to do whatever it takes to bring the real killer to justice. You know, I hear OJ is still looking for the real killer out on the golf course. Well, actually, I guess he's not looking for anyone right now because that piece of shit's behind bars. But if he ever gets out, maybe him and Cortez can join forces, or him and Dario can join forces and they can find the real killers together. He put Castro in a match with Pentagon Dark. Pentagon beat him with a package pile driver. Broke his arm after the match. This guy breaks arms like I change underwear here. Which, contrary to rumors, is every day, okay? Don't be smart. What was I going to say? He then cut a promo. Yes, he did. He cut a promo in Spanish. The only guy who can cut promos in Spanish, and even though I don't understand half of what he says, although they do have the captions at least, but I don't have to hear. I don't have to understand what he's saying. He makes his points very clear. There is nobody better at that than Pentagon Jr. I could listen to this guy speak all day, even if I don't understand a word of what he's saying. He cut a promo, though, saying he doesn't care who wins tonight between Dragon Azteca and Chavo Guerrero because the winner gets him. He says he'll take them out because his name is Pentagon Dark, and he has no fear. Cero miedo. Phoenix, Drago, and Aerostar teamed up with Sexy Star. Two stars in this match. Against the Worldwide Underground. Again, Jack Evans wrestled, but he didn't do much. Although he did win. He got the win for his team. He got a jackknife backslide for the win on Sexy Star. Taya took a bump toward the end. She kind of got... she kind of flew... It didn't look like anything overly bad. She went for some kind of move. She went through the middle and the bottom rope, but kind of like landed on the apron, then went off the apron and hit the floor, but she immediately grabbed her ankle and started screaming in pain. Mundo, PJ Black, and Jack Evans did help her to the back after the match. I don't know if it's a legit injury or not. It looked legit. I'm trying to go back in my mind if I heard during the tapings if Taya got hurt. I know, oh my God, what's his name? I already forgot his name. The skateboard guy. The guy that teamed with Son of Havoc. Ugh. I can't remember. Oh, and Helico. See, out of sight, out of mind. These guys get forgotten very easily if you are gone for too long. And Helico, I know he got hurt. That's why he's been missing. I don't remember if this was a case of her actually hurting her ankle or not, but it looked legit to me. So either that or she's really good at her job. Backstage somewhere, Katrina snaps Purple Skeletor's neck and kills him. She kills Sinestro de la Muerte and inhales all of his power, which she then blows into Mil Muertes. She blew into him. I feel that's a very important distinction I need to make there. Dragon, Azteca Jr., and Chavo Guerrero with Rey Mysterio as the guest referee. Chavo ended up nailing Rey right in the face because he's an idiot. And so Rey nailed him. He knocked him right into a Rana from Dragon Azteca, who got the pin. So it will be El Dragon Azteca Jr. getting a match with Pentagon Dark at some point. I don't know if it's next week or not. They didn't say. Or if they did, I didn't hear it. Speaking of Pentagon Dark, the show ends with a vignette. Black Lotus is with her Black Lotus tribe of ninjas, and she vows to send her tribe to get Pentagon Dark. Pentagon Dark's made a lot of enemies here on this show. I guess that's easy to do, though, when you have no fear. And that's your Lucha Underground review. Time for the mailbag. Actually, we'll do the mailbag now, but it's kind of a question. A lot of people were asking me my thoughts on the presidential debate, so I figured I'll answer it here as part of the mailbag. So this doesn't come from any particular person, but I know at least a few of you wanted my thoughts on that. But if you do have questions for the mailbag, you could email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Just please remember to include your name and where you are from when you write in, especially if you want your question to possibly be read here on the air. It's very important to include that information. So, people wanted to know my thoughts on the first presidential debate. 84 million. That's the total number of viewers across all of the major TV networks that tuned in. I wasn't too far off. I predicted 90 million. And I think if you factor in all the bars and the restaurants, and I think 2.5 million people streamed it on Facebook, it probably was around 90 million. And get this, and I love this. So many people were watching this debate. Pornhub said that its traffic fell 16% right at 9 p.m. when the debate started. And then it came back to normal levels once it ended. Americans stopped watching porn to watch the debate. That's more of a commitment than actually registering to vote. I'm actually very impressed by that. So the debate, it went pretty much as I expected. He did himself no favors. The funniest moment to me was when Trump said, "I've got a great temperament." And the entire debate hall cackled and laughed him off the stage. I was just like, the wheels at that point, the wheels were starting to come off for him. He was clearly getting rattled. He was getting agitated. And he just goes, "Yeah, I've got a great temperament, damn it." It's like, dude, that was not the moment to be saying that. She got in this guy's head so badly. He allowed himself to get played so badly. He spent the next 5 days, fighting with a Miss Universe winner and telling people to check out her sex tape. Okay, as somebody in PR, that's about the point where if I'm working for this guy's campaign or if I'm one of his kids, I'm grabbing his phone out of his hand and I'm smashing that thing against the wall. Or at the very least, I'm grabbing that phone and I'm changing the password or something. Anything to lock him out of Twitter. By the way, in all of this, I actually learned something here. I learned that this former Miss Universe, who, you know, became the subject of all of this talk this week when she got brought up during the debate, she apparently was once engaged to Bobby Abreu, who used to play for the Phillies and the Mets. He played for the Mets for about 3 weeks. So how about that? The more you know. It was also the first time Howard Stern and Rosie O'Donnell were name-dropped in a presidential debate. I was fully expecting a Vince McMahon mention, but it never came. So it's on to the next one. Next Sunday, head-to-head with No Mercy, which means probably no Sound Off Extra review for that pay-per-view, because if I'm going to watch this train wreck, and I am going to have to watch it live. So we'll see, but right now I'm leaning towards watching the debate and skipping the pay-per-view until later in the week. I'm just amazed that it's gotten to this point. I look at this whole thing, I just look at it, the two most hated candidates ever in the history of American politics, well, presidential politics, unfavorable numbers through the roof. We started with 17 dingbats on one side, about half that on the other, and these are the last two standing. This is the best of the best. In a country of, I think, what is it, 318 million people? This is the best that we have to offer. How sad is that? You know who I wish would have ran this year? And he really missed his window. This year of all years would have been his best shot. Jesse Ventura. Chris Jericho had Ventura on his podcast a few weeks ago. And I know Jesse's gone off the reservation with some of his conspiracy theories. He even had a TV show about nothing but conspiracy theories. But he's a pretty smart dude. If you listen to him speak, he's a pretty smart dude. Every bit as charismatic as Trump. For as effective as Trump has been in using that showman persona. He's a TV guy, so he gets it. He knows. As charismatic as he can be, Ventura blows him out of the water. And like he pointed out on Jericho's podcast, he's got something that neither one of these two have, which is military experience, right? He was a Navy SEAL. Now, I don't personally think that having a military background should be a prerequisite for being a good president. No, okay, it's like no more than being an ex-wrestler would make you a great wrestling promoter, but don't think that wouldn't have been a big advantage for him over these other two. Okay, I think it would have been great to have him in these debates. Hillary would be an afterthought. Are you kidding me? She wouldn't be able to get a word in edgewise against those two. You'd forget that she was even there. Now, I don't know about all of his policies. I'm not saying I'd vote for the guy, but you know, you look at the political climate in this country being what it is right now, I really do think this was the year for Ventura to run if he was ever going to. If he ever had a real shot. And I don't know how that would have worked out because, again, you know, you got the two major parties. It's so hard to be like a third-party person. And, you know, I mean, Perot did it, and there are examples like Nader did it. But, like, I don't know. That might have done him in. But I really think if he ever had a real shot, this would have been the year for it. And I think he missed his chance. And if it was him and Trump on that stage, he would have destroyed Trump in those debates. He would have eaten him alive. No doubt about it in my mind. By the way, here's a website. If you are a political junkie like I am and you love following these things, there's a website for you to check out. 270towin.com. I'm sure some of you have heard of it before. It's the number 270towin.com. Okay, it gives you an interactive presidential election map. I love this thing. I play with it every day. For those who don't live in this country or... And we have a lot of listeners who are younger as well, and we have listeners all over the world. we decide the presidency through the Electoral College. It's not the popular vote. So you could technically win the popular vote, but still lose the election. Each state has a designated number of electoral votes. So if you win that state, you get however many votes are allocated to that state. And the first person to reach 270 votes becomes the president. That's how it works. The map, if you look at the map, it's already pre-shaded with the states that Hillary is pretty much guaranteed to win. It's shaded with the states that Trump is pretty much favored and guaranteed to win. So you'll see the starting out point, I don't have the map in front of me, but the starting out point on the map, I think it's set on, it's like 200 votes for her and like 160 or 163, I think, for him. And from there, you can I mean, you could change every state if you want to. You can give them all to him, you can give them all to her. But they give you that starting point, and from there, you can shade the gray-colored states, either red or blue, depending on who you think is going to win each state. So I've mapped this out. I've been doing nothing but, like, mapping this out every single day. Like, new polls come in, and again, can you trust all the polls? Look, there are some pollsters that have a better track record than others. I admit, nobody really knows what the hell's going to happen here. Nobody knows. And anybody who tells you they know exactly what's going to happen is bullshitting you. They don't know. This is an election like none we've ever seen before. So you can pretty much take all of that stuff and throw it out the window because it really doesn't apply here. But I still, yeah, I look at the polls as they come in and I you know, you look at the different numbers and the different states and everything. And if you play with this map, I've mapped this out a dozen different ways already. A lot can change between now and Election Day, but right now, if I'm being generous, okay, and I give Trump Ohio and North Carolina, and I would, by the way, I know we have listeners in probably every single state, but especially if you're in like some of these battleground states like Ohio and stuff, like I don't care who you're voting for, it doesn't matter to me, but I would be curious to know like where you live in your town, in your county or whatever. You could just email me or tweet me, either way. What's your sense of things? We hear a lot of things about like Florida and Ohio and these different states, but it's always better to actually hear from people who are there, if they know their neighbors and stuff. Like, what's the sense of maybe who has the advantage there? I'd be curious to know. But if I'm being generous, I'm giving Trump Ohio and North Carolina. If I give him both of those, and I give her Florida because I think she's winning Florida. And Pennsylvania, which she's all but guaranteed to win Pennsylvania, then she wins 301 to 235, according to my map. That's my early prediction, which is a very early prediction because there's still a month to go. But that's my early prediction about how this ends up. Clinton 301, Trump 235. But check it out for yourself. There is one scenario where I mapped it out and they ended up tied, 268 to 268. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? Wouldn't that be the most appropriate end to this insanity if they tied each other? They tie like Sheamus and Cesaro. If this were WWE, they'd be forced to be co-presidents. Micah writes in, how do you disband the New Day? 400 plus days with the tag team titles. We know they'll lose the straps at some point, although I don't think they'll break up immediately after, but I am very curious about how WWE will have them go their separate ways. Any ideas? I don't think that you need to do like a heel turn, like Big E turns heel, Kofi turns heel. I think that there will come a point where they start to fade, and I don't see that point coming anytime soon because they're still selling merch. They have cereal. They have cereal, for God's sakes. They're not breaking these guys up. But when the time comes that it is time to move on to something else, I think it'll just be an amicable split where they just kind of, and maybe it's like some kind of a segment where they all agree we're going to go our separate ways, and, you know, we're going to go after this title or that title, and they just do a very amicable split. And I do think Big E is a very bizarre guy. I think he's a funny guy. I think it would take some effort to, I don't think it would take that much effort, maybe a little bit of effort to convince people to take him seriously for like a Universal Championship match. I think over the course of just a few weeks, if Big E just had this complete change in demeanor, maybe somebody did something to him. Maybe they viciously attacked Xavier Woods or something. like bloodied him up and put him out of action, and that's what kind of set Big E off, where he's not the fun-loving Big E anymore. He starts coming out and smashing guys. I don't know that it would take that much effort to convince people that this is somebody to take seriously, even though he's acted like a complete goof for the last, whatever it is, year and a half. Big E has potential. I really think he's got potential to be, you know, in maybe, I don't know about the top guy, but like be in that mix. He's a very athletic, bigger guy. He's not tall, but he's big and jacked, and I think he could go far. Kofi's one of those guys that's been around, like a Ziggler. He's been around probably for a decade or more at this point. And we've seen him in so many different situations. We've seen him as tag partners with so many different people, and face and heel, and, you know, as the Jamaican guy and as the New Day guy. And I don't know that people would accept him if they ever tried to push him as like a top guy. I mean, he's a talented guy, but I feel he may be the victim of just being around for so long that people just have this image of him, of him being at a certain level, and I don't know that he can break that. Big E has not been around as long as Kofi has, but I think Big E also has certain physical gifts that these other guys just don't, and that's why I think he could go further. Xavier, I think, could be very valuable to them in a lot of different ways. You know, he runs the up-up-down-down channel for them, and that's doing very well, and he's really articulate and well-spoken. He seems completely likable. He's just a great ambassador for that company. He's a good wrestler, but he's a great ambassador. But I don't see him ever, I mean, you know, we're not going to see Xavier Woods wrestling for the Universal Championship on a regular basis. His ceiling, I think, as far as in the ring, is only so high. But, you know, Big E's the one I would look at and say, if any of those three had the real potential to be in that main event mix at some point, it's Big E. But I don't see them breaking up where this guy turns on that guy, or Kofi turns on him, or Xavier turns on all of them. I think that you do it where at one point they just come to the realization that, hey, we got to go our separate ways and try our thing. Let's all be friends, but the New Day is no longer a thing, and they all just kind of go off and do their own thing. I don't think you have to have it where, like the Shield, where one guy turns on the others. Wesley from Ohio. Wesley, we're just talking about Ohio. With this whole Cesaro and Sheamus confusion, I'm a little worried for Gallows and Anderson. I'm worried for their future. Do you think that there's any hope for them on Raw as is? What would you do if you were booking them? I could tell you what I wouldn't do. I wouldn't do what they've been doing. I could tell you that. I think there's hope for them after New Day breaks Demolition's record. I think that maybe that's what they're doing. Maybe they're just waiting. And they're like, okay, we want to wait. It's like CM Punk all over again, right? CM Punk, they wanted him to get to a certain point in his run, in his reign. With him, it wasn't so much a number. I think it was more, we got to get him to The Rock. We have this idea for the Royal Rumble. The Rock's going to get a championship match. We've got to get him to January. And so Ryback, in the meantime, gets hot and ends up in this championship pay-per-view main event against Punk and gets beaten. And Ryback is killed dead and really is never the same after that. So Ryback was the real victim in that scenario. And here, you know, to a lesser degree, I think Gallows and Anderson may be the victim of the same exact thing. Maybe they put the titles on them, you know, a month ago, but they have it in their head. We've gotten this far. We want them to break Demolition's record. It's going to be another two and a half months. If we could just wait that long, Anderson and Gallows at that point will put the belts on them. The problem is, like with Ryback, it was too late. And these guys, the more they lose and they lose and they lose, it's not even like they're trying to protect them by keeping them away from the New Day. They had the Shining Stars feuding with Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy. The fucking Shining Stars. Why not take Anderson and Gallows and have them feud with Cass and Enzo for a few months? Is it so important to get the Shining Stars on TV? Now, I guess the question then becomes, well, if Anderson and Gallows aren't fighting for the tag titles, then who is? There's got to be some other team. If there isn't, draft them to Raw. Find someone. But don't kill these guys dead, which is exactly what they've done. So even if the plan is to put the belts on them in 2 months and give them a monster run, hey, maybe they'll end up being okay. Maybe they'll end up okay. But to me, by then, it's too late. Because if you lose and you lose and you lose and you lose and you lose, when you finally win, what does it really mean? Look at Ziggler. That's the whole storyline he's in right now. He loses, he loses, he loses, he loses, he loses to everyone. So let's say he beats The Miz and he wins the Intercontinental Championship at No Mercy. They've told a good story with it. It may get a big pop that night, but what does it really mean? What is it really doing for Dolph? Where's it going? What's it leading to? Nothing. Because Dolph, he's in his spot. He's exactly where he is on the card and where he'll always be, and the fans know that, and they're never going to take him seriously at a high level. These guys came in, they had, you know, they were talking about their background in Japan. They hooked them up with AJ. AJ was having pay-per-view main events, so that kind of rubbed off on them a little bit because AJ was important. It made them feel important. And then they broke him up, and, to this day, I don't know why they did that. And AJ doesn't know why they did that. AJ was as upset as anybody. I interviewed him at that 2K17 event, and I asked him about that. And I said, hey, dude, you know, I saw the segment on the YouTube channel where when you found out that these guys were drafted to another show, you looked like your dog died. He's like, yeah, it sucked. Of course it sucked. It never should have happened. There was no reason to break them up. So, again, they can wait until they break the record and then put the belts on them, but will it even matter at that point? What I would do, you ask me what I would do, I would trade them over to SmackDown. Trade them over to SmackDown, hook them back up with AJ. It's not too late. They never should have been split up in the first place. I would love to see them do something with Finn Balor. Maybe that was the plan. Who knows? We'll never know. Maybe they were going to do something with Finn Balor in these next few months. But if Balor ain't coming back for another 4, 5, 6 months, they're going to be deader than dead if they just wait around for Finn Balor to come back. If that's even... I'm not saying that was the plan. I'm just saying if it was. Balor's not going to come back for a long time yet. You can't just keep these guys in a holding pattern until he comes back or until they break the demolition record. These guys are better than that. They shouldn't be wasted in this way. They came in with momentum and they squandered it. Put them on SmackDown and hook them back up with AJ. It's not too late. Clifton from Nettleton, Mississippi. What were your thoughts on the European Championship? And do you think WWE should have brought it back for heel international stars like Rusev or Cesaro in 2012 or the League of Nations back when they were around? The European title, I thought it looked cool. It was a title. It was a belt. It was just another belt, you know, nothing more, nothing less. I thought when Rusev first won it the first time, they should have had him come out the next night or the next week. I don't remember if he won it on a pay. I think he did. He won it on a pay-per-view. They should have had him come out the very next night, drop it in a garbage can, and bring back the European title in its place. And then John Cena could have brought the U.S. title back on Raw, you know, the night after WrestleMania when he won it. Would have put even more heat on the guy. Eustace from Harlem. Other than the antiquated Montreal Screwjob answer, what was the event that set off the biggest chain reaction in the history of wrestling, at least in America? Vince McMahon taking over from his father. That'd be my answer. Joey from Canada. I recently got to thinking about the final match in the WrestleMania trilogy between Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock and how great it was. I've always been of the opinion that it should have been the main event of WrestleMania 19. It also ended up being Austin's final match, even though WWE did not go about promoting it that way. My question is, do you think it would have been a bigger match, and do you think it could or should have main evented the show if it were indeed promoted as Austin's retirement match? Austin versus Rock Act 3 had such a strong story going for it at the time, especially with Hollywood Rock wanting to desperately beat the Rattlesnake finally at WrestleMania. I can't imagine how much more spectacular it would have been had the prospect of Austin's retirement been added to the plot. All due respect to Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar and the WWE Championship, but I would have personally put that match on last. What say you? Absolutely. If it was promoted as Austin's last match going in, you have to make that the main event. How do you not? How do you not make that the main event? Austin is one of the biggest stars, if not the biggest, in the history of that company. How do you not make that match a main event if you are promoting it, potentially, as his retirement match? It's just like they did with Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker, WrestleMania 26. Now, that also was not for a championship. They took the WWE title match. And actually, back then, that was, I think, still during the first brand split. So they had two title matches, if I'm not mistaken. They would have had two championship matches on that show, both of which went on before the main event. Why? Because Shawn and Undertaker was such a big match. It deserved the main event. It deserved the main event the year before, too. They didn't do Triple H and Randy Orton any favors by putting those guys on last at WrestleMania 25. So they did it with Shawn and Undertaker at WrestleMania 26. Difference is, it wasn't promoted as Shawn Michaels' final match, only that his career was on the line. Here, I don't think I would have promoted it as Austin's retirement match. Because to me, why spoil the finish, right? Why tell people going in? Why not make it career versus career and have the stipulation be that one of these two guys, two of the biggest names ever in this company, the two big stars of the Attitude Era, and we're guaranteeing you going into this thing, one of these guys will never wrestle again. Their career will be over. They will be forced to retire. And keep the fans guessing who it's going to be. I bet you most people would have figured it'd be The Rock. Because The Rock was already making movies. He was coming in and out. He wasn't a full-time guy anymore. It would have been very easy, I think, for people to be like, all right, The Rock, he's big Mr. Hollywood now. Obviously, he's leaving. I think most people would have picked The Rock. They would have figured he was the one who was going to be retiring. And then when it's Austin who loses, clean in the middle to a rock bottom, no less, that's an even bigger shock. Not just that Austin would be the one who would have to retire, but Austin had never lost to The Rock at WrestleMania. He certainly never lost a match clean to him that I can remember. So for Rock to put him down in the middle with a rock bottom and get the three, I mean, to me, it would have been one of those genuine, like, Undertaker streak-ending type moments where you pan to the crowd and you have people with their jaws just on the floor. It would have been one of those moments. So Rock gets to exercise his WrestleMania demons over Austin. He leaves Austin in the ring to get that one last big reaction and drink one last beer before making that long walk up the aisle. You know, to me, a star of Austin's caliber, he deserved a bigger send-off than what he got that night. Look, he did it his way. He didn't want to make a big deal about it. He knew going in that it was his last match. I don't know that WWE knew. I don't remember if he told them that or if that was just something he kept to himself. Austin did, you know, he did it his way. So, I mean, who am I to say? I'm just saying, you know, if I had the power over it and I'm looking at this as a promoter, that's how I promote it. And if I know going in, okay, Austin's like, look, I'm done. This is going to be my last match. I go to him and I say, well, what do you think about this? Why don't we do it this way? Keep the fans guessing. Up the stakes. We can promote the match around that. I think the loser leaves town stip with Austin losing would have been much more shocking. And honestly, instead of it being just another match on the card, which it was just Stone Cold against The Rock. Nothing wrong with that, but yeah, you know, there was no stipulation. There was no drama built up around it. When I think back to as poorly as that WrestleMania did, buy rate-wise, that WrestleMania is still very much an anomaly. If you look at the chart, like the buy rate chart for WrestleMania, like 17, 18, 19, 20, you see 19 in there, and it's like way down compared to everything else. And that was a pretty loaded show. I mean, you had Austin against Rock, which is always going to be a big-time match. It's Shawn Michaels, his first WrestleMania match in God knows how many years, coming back, wrestling Chris Jericho. You had Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar for the championship in the main event. You had Hulk Hogan against Vince McMahon, which was promoted as the real main event. That's four big matches right there. And for whatever reason, with all that star power, Hogan and Austin and Rock and Shawn and Vince and Triple H was on there, it didn't do great at all. So I look back and I say, okay, as badly compared to the other Manias as this one did, I wonder, had you promoted it? I guarantee you with that stipulation, career-ending match Austin versus Rock, it would have done much better on pay-per-view than it did. If people knew going in that either Austin or Rock were wrestling their final match, WrestleMania 19 would have done much bigger business, without a doubt. Kofi. Not that one, from London, UK. Apart from 1995, what were the other years that made you almost quit watching wrestling? Also, what years made you love watching wrestling? I don't know that there was any year other than 95 where I came that close to just, like, not watching. I'll be honest, you know, there were a lot of years there in the 2000s. It's all kind of a blur. I just kind of meshed them all, like, from 06 maybe to, like, 2011... I don't know. A lot of those years just kind of blend together for me. They really weren't overly good or exciting. But I don't think I ever came close to just like throwing my hands up in the air and not watching. Only at the beginning of 95. That's where I really came close. As far as what years made me love watching wrestling, I mean, when I was a kid, growing up in the 80s. I mean, come on, that was the golden era. Are you kidding me? Hogan and Savage and Piper and Jake the Snake and all those guys, all those colorful characters in primetime wrestling, and Bobby Heenan, Gorilla Monsoon, Brother Love Show, WrestleFest the arcade game, WrestleMania the game. My first video game for NES, I guess aside from Duck Hunt and whatever came with the... I had the gun for Duck Hunt and all that. But I think the first game I ever had my parents buy me was the WrestleMania game. It had like Hogan on the cover ripping his shirt. And it had Andre in the game, Hogan, DiBiase, Bam Bam. I think Honky Tonk Man was in there. I still remember playing that game. I had a WrestleMania handheld game too. So you can't beat that. I mean, when you're a kid, come on. I mean, there's probably people listening right now who grew up in the Attitude Era, and I'm sure their answer would be the Attitude Era. And the Attitude Era would be an answer for me too. That would be the next thing. I mean, I love the 80s. I love 1992. I've made that very clear. I love that year in WWE. I just do. I love that year. But then the Attitude Era, you know, I mean, come on. The Attitude Era was just a lot of fun because you had these two companies that were going at it, and you could flip on Monday night. You had a choice. And it wasn't even so much, oh, I'm bored, let me see what's going on the other channel. I mean, you had two shows where you didn't want to turn away and you didn't know what to do. You couldn't just say, oh, I'll set the DVR. Unless you had a VCR like in another room and you can just tape the other show, you were pretty much at the mercy of whoever you wanted to watch in the moment. But looking back on it, it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was exciting. It was fun to be a wrestling fan back then. I can't say that I've had that same feeling since. I can't say that I've had that feeling. Yeah, I enjoy it. I watch it, but there's no one year that stands out to me. I can't say, well, 2014 was a great year. It really wasn't. 2015 was a great year in wrestling. Nah, really wasn't. Like, there's nothing that stands out to me. Oh, so much fun. I'm still waiting. I keep saying, oh, habit and hope, the two H's. That's why I keep watching. I watch it out of habit, and I keep hoping it's going to get better. And there's a lot to like right now about wrestling. Yeah, there really is. I mean, I don't want to make it sound doom and gloom. Wrestling sucks. There's a lot that I like about it, but there's nothing about any particular year in the last decade plus that stands out to me as that was like a magical year. That year was so much fun. They really just haven't been able to recapture that magic. And hopefully one of these years they can. Maybe they will. Maybe next year will be the best year yet, right? Who knows? Probably as long as Raw stays 3 hours, I won't hold my breath. But hey, SmackDown's having something of a renaissance right now. I really, you know what? I enjoyed the hell out of SmackDown in 2002 and 2003. That I did. If I had to pick one thing from those years, it would be SmackDown. So maybe as time goes on, SmackDown will get even better. And because I'm enjoying the hell out of it right now. It's only been 2 months. But you never know. 2017, maybe that'll be the year. Vinny from New Jersey has a buy or sell. I feel that WrestleMania 8 and WrestleMania 10 were both very similar in that they each had two classic matches and a forgettable rest of the card. Because of this, I am giving you two buy or sells. As a whole show, WrestleMania 8 or WrestleMania 10. Well, those are two of my favorite WrestleMania shows. So those are two fine choices right there. If I'm looking at the shows overall, I've got to go with... Ooh, that's tough. That's actually tough. You know, I probably would go at WrestleMania 10. Because I can point to Bret and Owen, I can point to the ladder match, the whole like dual championship match thing with the world title was kind of interesting. I didn't think the main event was really anything special, but I enjoyed the Savage Crush match. If anything, I thought that match was too short. They had like a falls count anywhere in the building match. They had a big feud going for many months, so that's like three really solid matches right there. When I look at WrestleMania 8, I think of the Intercontinental title match with Bret Hart and Roddy Piper. I think of the championship match with Savage and Flair. The Hogan-Sid match was nothing special, but it was kind of fun to see the Ultimate Warrior make his big comeback there at the end. Place went nuts for it. It was just this electric moment, even though it didn't... Even though it looked like Warrior was put in the dryer, he got left in there for a little too long. He didn't look the same as I had remembered him. And contrary to all the rumors and myths over the years, it was not a fake Ultimate Warrior. Ultimate Warrior did not die in a car crash. That started so many years ago. It was, in fact, the Ultimate Warrior. But beyond those two matches, there really weren't any great, like, matches or big moments from WrestleMania 8. I liked it. Actually, you know what? The Undertaker-Jake match, look, you're not going to watch that match and think, what a great match. But I actually liked it. I liked it, and I laugh to this day when Undertaker gives Jake a tombstone on the floor, and his head is probably 6 inches off the ground. That's kind of funny. And actually, Gorilla Monsoon coined the phrase Tombstone City long before Brock Lesnar coined the phrase Suplex City, if you go back and watch that spot. But I'd probably give the edge to WrestleMania 10. I just think it was a better... Overall, it was a better show. Had a few, you know, a few more matches that probably... Gives it the edge, tips the scales there. The other half of the buy or sell here, Bret Hart versus Roddy Piper and Randy Savage versus Ric Flair, or Bret Hart versus Owen Hart and Razor Ramon versus Shawn Michaels, which matches would you favor more? I got a buy on the WrestleMania 10 matches, Bret and Owen, Shawn and Razor. It's not just that those are the two best matches on that WrestleMania card. Those are two of the best matches in the history of that company. I mean, those are two matches that even... How many years has it been? Over 20 years now? People still talk about those matches. They still point to those matches. The ladder match... I mean, that's the ladder match by which all other ladder matches are always compared. I mean, now they do things in ladder matches. I saw some highlights from... I know Ring of Honor had a pay-per-view on Friday night, and they had a ladder war. The Young Bucks and the Addiction. And I didn't see the match. I want to, but I didn't have a chance to see it. But I, you know, look at a match like that. I saw them doing, what was it, the Indie Taker off the ladder. Look at all the crazy shit they do in these matches today. You're not going to watch Shawn and Razor in 94 and see crazy shit the way we see crazy shit now, but it was crazy back then. Shawn Michaels to pick up a ladder and just throw it across the ring right into Razor's back. That was pretty brutal. Shawn doing a splash off the top of the ladder. That was pretty crazy. We didn't really see that back then. But you go back now, it's not even like, oh, the match isn't what I remember it as being. I watch these matches, and to me, they stand the test of time. It's every bit as good now as it was back then. That right there is the hallmark of a great match. And those two matches you mentioned from WrestleMania 8 are fantastic. I love them. But to me, you can't put them over those two matches from WrestleMania 10. So I'm going to buy on that and sell on the WrestleMania 8 matches.
Whether you like it or you don't, The Rock still leaves here your people's champion. As of now, Sing Along with The Rock is over.
What you heard there is pretty rare. I think it was only used maybe on one WWE DVD that they did for The Rock many years ago. It was the night that The Rock officially turn heel after dropping the championship to Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam in 2002. In fact, that was the very same night, right after the match ended. The crowd turned on him badly that night. They cheered for Lesnar. Didn't air on TV, but when the match was over, he took the mic. He told them, you know, Sing Along with The Rock is over. And we didn't see The Rock again for many months. That would be, of course, for the debut of Hollywood Rock when he came back. My favorite incarnation of The Rock ever. And that leads us to our countdown this week. My list of the top 9 best, my favorite WWE interviews and promos of all time. I have been ranking what I feel are the top 9 best. And this week, we are up to number 5 here on the countdown. Last week, I talked about Paul Heyman's work shoot on Vince McMahon from SmackDown in 2001. That was number 6 in the countdown. Number 5 this week takes us back to Monday Night Raw. From February 24th, 2003, the night after the No Way Out pay-per-view where Rock defeated Hulk Hogan for the second time, this time with an assist from a crooked Canadian referee named Sylvain Grenier. It was all a master plan hatched by Vince McMahon to screw Hulk Hogan. Rock did Vince a favor that night, and so in return, Vince allowed Rock to switch to the Raw brand. And the next night on Raw in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, Eric Bischoff, who was the Raw GM at the time, introduced The Rock at the start of the show. He had been a SmackDown guy, so people were surprised to see him on this show. And since he had come back, Rock went full-on just arrogant Hollywood prick who thought he was better than everybody else. He'd show up via satellite on SmackDown and cut some of the funniest promos you'll ever see. It was one where he started dozing off while Hulk Hogan was speaking. I can't say I blame him. And so now here he was on Raw, but why? Why is he on Raw? Nobody knew why. So I'm going to play the audio for you. I've tried to cut it down a little bit here, but it's a little over 7 minutes long. This is the famous Rock promo, Hollywood Rock promo from Toronto on Raw in 2003.
Finally! The Rock has come back to Toronto!
He's not quite finished.
Toronto!
He's almost there.
To run his mouth on all your candy asses!
What about that? There's a lot of candy asses out there, Darren. Thousands of them.
Oh yeah, the Rock is on Raw.
Why? It's a SmackDown number one draft pick. Several moons ago. Maybe if these Canucks will shut up, let him explain, maybe he'll tell us why he's here on Raw.
Whoa. Now, don't start chanting Rocky yet. You got to hear what the Rock is going to say, and then you decide whether you're going to chant Rocky or not.
There you go.
Yeah, big surprise. The Rock right here on Raw. Why? The Rock will tell you why. The Rock will tell you why because, see, last night at No Way Out, The Rock did Vince McMahon a favor, and he whooped that red and yellow candy ass.
These people are in denial.
And then, Vince McMahon did The Rock a favor. He said, Rock, you can go wherever you want to go. You can do whatever you want to do. So The Rock said he wanted to go live Monday night on Raw. More importantly than that, The Rock said he wanted to come right here to Toronto, Canada.
I think Rock's sucking up in this crowd, if you ask me.
And then The Rock said, wait a minute. Are you kidding, The Rock? Are you kidding, The Rock? What? Is this the first time you've ever heard someone mention your city? Is that it? Oh, yay! Hooray! He said Toronto! Yay! Woo! Yay! That's where we live! We live in Toronto! Yay! Shut up!
Oh. Sometimes there's not a lot to cheer about living here in Toronto. I beg your pardon.
Hey, see, The Rock wanted to come right here to Toronto because, you see, it was here in Toronto that it all started.
What started? I don't know.
Yeah, The Rock didn't forget. The Rock didn't forget because, you see, the biggest travesty in the history of the industry, it was here in Toronto that the people turned on the people's champion.
Ah! What does he mean by that? What do you mean, what does he mean by that?
Oh, no, don't, no, we didn't, Rock, no, we, oh, yes, you did. Oh, The Rock, yes, you did, baby, yes, you did. Last year, WrestleMania, 68,000 strong, 68,000 of you mother Canuckers booing The Rock out of the building.
Mother Canuckers, they're mother Canuckers, they are. Well, that's totally disrespectful.
Isn't it? I knew they were.
And uncalled for, quite frankly.
So what'd you think? Did you actually think that The Rock was just going to forget? Is that what you thought? That The Rock was just going to forget? That The Rock was just going to let it slide? Is that what you think?
They are mother Canuckers, you know.
It doesn't matter what you people think.
Oh. I just can't believe this attitude from The Rock, quite frankly.
I guess The Rock told Toronto, did he?
Well, you don't boo The Rock, are you, fatty? The Rock gets more pie in a week than you get in a lifetime.
I've never had pie.
But there's one thing that bothered The Rock more than that. It was at Raw's 10th anniversary that the people did not vote for The Rock to be Superstar of the Decade.
Ooh. That was actually Austin's accolade.
You voted for Stone Cold Steve Austin.
What the crowd?
Yeah. Oh, The Rock knows everybody loves Stone Cold Steve Austin. Yeah. Yeah, everybody loves Stone Cold. Yeah. Yeah, well, The Rock doesn't love Stone Cold. The Rock doesn't love Stone Cold. As a matter of fact, Stone Cold Steve Austin is nothing.
The Rock sounds jealous. He's got to be jealous. Must be.
And The Rock means nothing compared.
Don't do that.
Compared to The Rock. No. You see, there is only one. There's only one true superstar of the decade, true superstar of the millennium. You know who that is? The Rock will tell you who that is. Toronto, that is the jabroni beating, pie eating, trailblazing, eyebrow raising, stronger than a bear, faster than a buck, the biggest thing to hit Canada because the Maple Leafs suck.
Oh! Oh, man! Good grief. Oh, The Rock is on a roll! After letting...
He's on fire tonight!
He left Hogan in a bloody mess and no way out, and now inciting this crowd. This attitude. That sign.
If you don't believe that, then maybe you'll believe this. You see, there's a big battle royal that's going to happen tonight. And The Rock is gonna just toss his head in that battle royal, because The Rock is gonna come in here. He's gonna throw all that candy acid out of the ring. The Rock is gonna win the battle royal. The Rock is going on to WrestleMania, and The Rock will become your world champion.
The Rock is gonna be in the battle royal here tonight on Raw.
I guess he is.
Back up.
Lock it or not.
Back up, JR.
Just some mellow. What The Rock. Whoa. Time out. Whoa.
Another big mistake.
Now, see, that ain't not... Hey, you were the first to boo The Rock, so you were the very first to lose that sing-along privilege. No more.
Stop.
You can't sing along with The Rock. No. No.
They can't.
No more. Since you were first to boo The Rock, The Rock says this. Hey, Canada, you know what? Hell. Know your role, just shut your mouth, take all your booze, stick them straight up your maple syrup, sucking candy acid.
Good grief. I cannot believe this attitude.
The Rock, and only The Rock, has the privilege of saying this. Is cooking.
That guy had that crowd eating out of his hand. Did you hear that crowd after he made that crack about the Maple Leafs? That's my favorite part of the whole thing. Just how incensed they were with him. Now, I cheap heat that part, but that was, to me, my favorite part of the whole thing. It was the Superstar of the Decade Award that they had used as an excuse to reignite the feud with him and Austin heading into WrestleMania 19. I was at that Raw show the week after this promo. They came to the Nassau Coliseum when he and Austin had a face-off. And anytime those two were in the same ring together, it was awesome. I like the callback in this promo to WrestleMania the year before in Toronto, where he said, that's where it all started. That's where you people turned on me. Even though it really kind of wasn't. Technically, it was Houston, WrestleMania 17, where the crowd first turned on him. Although, I guess they would argue, well, it was just the hometown crowd for Austin. That's the reason why. But still, two manias in a row, the crowd loudly booed The Rock in favor of the other guy. That whole Hollywood Rock run that he had, as short as it was, and it was far too short. We've seen guys, like Batista's another one. Batista, when they turned him heel, he finally clicked. It was early in like 2010. And he had that great run where he'd come out dressed up like a member of the Village People, but he was just fucking great. It only lasted like 3 months. He won the championship. He held the title for like a month, and then Cena won it from him. But I wish they could have gone further with it. Unfortunately, he decided he just, you know, he had enough and he left the company. But I kind of compare that to the whole Hollywood Rock thing, where I feel like there was so much potential that was just squandered because the guys left far too early. But hey, that was their call, I guess. But I look at this run, as short as it was, but in that short span of time, he put over a bunch of guys. I mean, he beat Hogan in Austin, which is something that I don't know that anybody else can say that. But he worked with Hurricane, right? To this day, people still remember that backstage segment with the two of them. And then Hurricane got the fluke pin on Rock, which, yeah, they did that to help build the match with Austin. It was a totally fluky win, but still, he beat The Rock. Technically, he has a win over The Rock. On this show, even, the one that you just heard the audio from, Rock mentioned a battle royal that he was going to be wrestling in. That battle royal came down to two guys, Rock and Booker T. And Booker tossed him out. Booker won himself a championship match with Triple H at WrestleMania. And Rock is just sitting outside on the floor after he got dumped, and he's clapping for Booker. He's applauding Booker T. Here's the cocky, arrogant heel Rock just applauding this guy. He's pointing at him. He keeps mouthing, "Hey, he's pretty good. This guy's pretty good." And Goldberg is another one. Goldberg, he was the man responsible, Rock was, for bringing Goldberg into the company. And he did so that he can put Goldberg over on his way out, because Rock knew he was leaving again to go back to making a movie. So Goldberg came in. His very first match was against The Rock. He beat The Rock. But I look at this run, and I say that it was short, but it was productive. He got shit done during that run. And as far as promos go, I think it's still one of the best in the history of that company. So that's number five. Next week, we will do number four in the countdown as we get very close to the number one promo of all time. Promo, interview, I use the word interchangeably. It's not just limited to in-ring promos either. That's kind of why I use those words. So we're counting down to number one on the, I was going to say 6-year anniversary show, the 9-year, I don't know where six came from, the 9-year anniversary show of this podcast. I believe it's November 6th. That's where the number six came from. If we do a show every week without missing a beat, it should be the November 6th episode of the show. I want to take a moment here to wish all of my Jewish listeners, I know we have a lot, I want to wish them a very happy new year. You can follow me on Twitter at Solomonster is the handle. Put the poll up every week after Raw, at least, if not SmackDown. You can vote thumbs up, thumbs down, and take part in that. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel where Sound Off Extra episodes go up. Sound Off YouTube.com/TheSolomonster is the address there. Don't forget, you can take advantage of our Audible link. You want to pick up a copy of the Death of WCW audiobook for free. You get it for free, if you so choose, as part of your Audible trial. You can sample the service for 30 days, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. If for whatever reason, day 29 of the trial, this isn't for me, I'm going to cancel. That Death of WCW book, which you may or may not have already listened to, it belongs to you. It is yours. You own it. So take advantage of that offer on Audible. And anytime you want to make a PayPal donation, you can do so on thesolomonster.com. That's the place to go. So until next weekend, we will be back at that point for episode 464, I believe we are up to. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and we will see you back here next weekend. Until then, go Mets!
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the big show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Solomonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.